three. We're talking some NFL draft. Let's look at it from a Titans perspective. Let's bring on Easton Freeze, Broadway Sports, covering all thing Tennessee. Easton, top of the morning to you. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, fellas. Thanks for having me on.
What's the vibe like right now inside of Easton's head? You've been waiting for the draft. You've been working for this. You've been scouting. You've been looking at what the Titans need. You're almost to the finish line. How are you feeling?
The vibe is I'm tired, and the vibe is I'm nervous, and the vibe is I'm excited because this is the most chaotic potential, especially in the first round for a draft that I can remember. And the Titans in particular are in a very advantageous position to land a strong tackle or a strong wide receiver, potentially trade back and really shuffle the deck in the first round. They could do a number of things that would be exciting, and I think it's going to be a good time on Thursday night.
They're not in complete control of the draft in terms of the swing positions, but like they are kind of right there in that sweet spot where teams might start getting desperate and maybe things fall perfectly for them and they can get their top prospect, or maybe they have to even move up a couple spots. They are in an interesting position, like you said. Who do you want the Titans to draft? Who do you think their best pick would be? Is it Joe Alt? Is it a wide receiver? Because Tennessee has struggled with both in the recent years.
I'm firmly of the mind that they need to land a top offensive tackle just because of the way that the offensive tackle position works in the NFL. Historically speaking, the talent drops off precipitously after the first round, and this year's group in particular has six incredibly strong prospects that are all going to be first-round picks. The Titans are in position to have their pick of the best or second-best, I'd imagine, of them should they stay at seven. Now, if I had my druthers, I would have them moving back, gathering some extra day two capital. They don't have a third round pick this year. They sure could use one. And taking advantage of this deep tackle pool. I think all six of the top six guys are valuable and would be, arguably tackle one in any other class. And so if they could move back to 11, 12, 13, especially if a quarterback falls to seven and they could have one of those quarterback needy teams like the Vikings or the Broncos or the Raiders bite and come up for that guy, I think moving back and drafting a tackle would be ideal, but taking one to seven certainly wouldn't be a bad thing.
So you see the six linemen that are projected in the first round to all, I don't want to say be interchangeable, but not a wide gap between them?
I think it's a really narrow gap. Yeah, the top of the class is, of course, Joe Alt, who I think is the number one tackle in this class, just the most well-rounded guy, in my opinion, out of Notre Dame. There's a really thin margin in my mind between him and Fashanu out of Penn State. Fashanu is the best pass protector with a bullet, but he lacks a lot in the run blocking game. And then third, also a thin margin, is J.C. Latham out of Alabama. Mountain of a man, the strongest player in this draft. He plays right tackle, but I think he has left right side versatility, and he moves like a man that's much lighter than he is. So Alt, Fashanu, Latham are the top three for me. And then there's a small gap, and you get to guys like Talisa Fuaga out of Oregon State, who's the best run blocker in this class with a bullet, but is a little bit lacking in the pass protection game. Troy Fontenu out of Washington, who I think is the most underrated of the bunch. He's not got anything in particular that's super sexy about his game, but he's just a B+, A- across the board, looks like a pro on tape. And then Amarius Mims is the wild card out of Georgia. He'll probably be the sixth of the six off the board just because he only had eight starts in college. A lot of people call him raw. I think he's more inexperienced than he is raw. He's built in a lab to play tackle, incredible size, incredible height, incredible length. If he can stay healthy, he may very well in 3 years we look back and say, Amarius Mims, wow, he was the sixth guy off the board, and he was the best tackle in this class. But all six of those guys are really fantastic, and I'd imagine all of them go in the top 25 picks.
Easton, thanks for joining us this morning. The question I would have, and it feels like a long shot the more and more I look at this stuff, but in the event that something happens, it's a bit of a curveball, and there's actually somebody that picks, we'll say the Giants, picks ahead of the Titans and they take Joe Alt.
Right.
What do you think the Titans' strategy is at that point? Do they stay kind of quote-unquote on brand for the position need that they're looking for, or do they just go at that point after the best available talent that's, you know, right now maybe projected in front of Alt?
Right. So we spoke with Titans brass yesterday in their pre-draft press conference, and we asked them if there were any players on their board that were untrade backable, right? Guys that if they were there, they would not consider trading back from. And they said the short answer was yes. That's all that Rand Carthen gave on that front. I have it on decent authority that they really, really, really want to trade back no matter what, unless that guy or guys, if there's more than one of them, is there for them. We had it come out this morning from Diana Russini talking about how they really fell in love with Marvin Harrison Jr. out of Ohio State, the top wide receiver in this class during the combine process. Not shocking they fell in love with the consensus wide receiver one, but I'd imagine he is one of, if not the only guy on that list of guys they would not trade down from. So that being said, even if Alt is there at seven, I think their priorities look like that guy and Marvin Harrison Jr. if he happens to somehow fall there, and then trading down. I think that's what they want to do, even if Alt is there. Now, if they can't find a partner because you got to have somebody to dance with to move in the draft, it's going to depend on what receivers are there. I think they like Malik Nabers out of LSU a lot. I think he presents a really fantastic fit for them. So if he is there and Alt is not, it would not shock me if he's the pick at all. There's other guys to consider, such as Ramadunze out of Washington, who's my pick for the second best receiver in this class, but his skill set might be a little bit redundant with some of the guys they have on the team already. So it's a good question. It would not shock me at all if their second tackle is actually J.C. Latham out of Alabama. Bill Callahan, the son of Brian Callahan, offensive line guru, the Titans' new offensive line coach, he spent a lot of time in this pre-draft process with Latham at his pro day. They had him in to visit. He's the kind of guy from a profile standpoint, Latham is, that fits the historical profile of the tackle prospect that Bill Callahan likes a lot. So it wouldn't shock me if he actually was the pick over a Fashanu at seven if they stuck there and took a tackle.
Easton, what did you make of Rand's comments yesterday that he's viewing this as his first draft?
I think it's kind of a throwaway statement. Honestly, I know a lot of people want to make more of it than I do because it's easy to say, what does that say about Mike Vrabel? And what does that say about the way that he was treated last year and the power that he had? I really didn't take it to mean that. I think that was more alluding to the fact that, you know, your first draft, you're kind of figuring it out all as you go. There's no handbook to being an NFL GM, and there's no handbook to the draft process. It's about working your contacts. It's about knowing the game, and you can't know it till you do it. So that's kind of how I took it, that he was last year figuring it out as he went, and this year he was able to go into it knowing exactly what he wanted to do, when, where, and why.
Easton, you know, the whole talk in this offseason for the Titans has been, you know, shoring up that offensive line, trying to get a tackle, and then trying to get some weapons on the outside for Will Levis. They obviously go out and do that in free agency with Ridley. And it feels like this coaching staff and Callahan still want to get some playmakers on that outside. But outside of those two positions, what do you feel like kind of is that third biggest need for this Tennessee team in the draft coming up? And then, you know, without that third-round pick, kind of where do you think that this team where is that strategy, do you think, in terms of that third pick that you're taking outside of an offensive lineman or a wide receiver on the outside?
So the third biggest need, just purely in terms of, you know, they don't have a guy on the roster and they need one, it's inside linebacker. Now, you could easily argue that in terms of positional value and impact on the field, it's maybe edge or defensive line, but it's one of those three. It's that upfront triangle on the defense. It's one of the linebackers or one of the guys up front, either on the inside or the outside. You ask what their strategy could be without that third round pick. The answer is they're going to be going into the season without somebody that they really need. Like, there, I don't see a world, you know, you go through the mock drafts, I've run the numbers on this, there really is not a world, unless they hit it really big a couple of times in the late rounds with some gems that they find, where they go into the season without a significant hole or two, if they don't add any day two capital. And that's a big part of the reason why I am so strongly in favor of them managing to find some more capital, trading back, doing what it takes to get another pick in the top 100 to add to the two that they already have. So I do think that the second round pick, regardless of what they do in the first, whether it's receiver or tackle, there's a very high likelihood that they are interested in one of the defenders there. one of the edge rushers, one of the defensive linemen. I think Junior Colson out of Michigan, if they were to go linebacker in the second at the 38th pick, I think Junior Colson is my pick for that. They had a meeting with him. He is a Nashville native, went to Ravenwood High School just down the road over here. Really strong linebacker. He's my best linebacker in this class. He does everything really well. It's a really weak linebacker class as well. There's really only three or four guys that imagine on each team's board that they would see as draftable starters, draftable green dot guys, and that's what the Titans really, really need right now. They brought in Kenneth Murray from the Chargers in the offseason. He's a downhill, heat-seeking missile-style linebacker who's going to be primarily working in run fits and rushing the passer. He's not going to be trusted in coverage, and you need a guy that can be the quarterback of the defense, can wear the green dot, can call the plays, and can fall into coverage reliably. Junior Colson is one of the only guys in this class that can do that.
Sticking with the linebackers there just quickly, can you talk a little bit about Peyton Wilson out of NC State? Obviously, he's got a ton of injury history, and that, you know, that's mm-hmm. obviously something that you're going to look for in that draft process. But that's a guy who, you know, when he is healthy, and he's been healthy the last year or so for that NC State team, he flies around on the field. And, you know, guys like Luke Kuechly and other big-time linebackers have spoken highly of him. What are your opinions on him and, you know, and his health, I guess?
Man, Peyton Wilson's such an interesting case, because you're right that he's fantastic when he's healthy. At least in college he was. And you could easily argue he is the strongest cover linebacker in this class, again, when he's out there on the field and when he's healthy. He's got an interesting frame that I'm curious to see how that's going to translate to the NFL. 91st percentile height, he's 6'4", but 6th percentile arm length. And folks will be like, well, does that really matter? At the NFL level, when you're going to be a linebacker trying to run fit and get after the passer and match hands with a blocker, you know, yes, he's a fantastic cover linebacker, but you're going to be asked to do a lot of that as an inside linebacker, and he's going to be at a length disadvantage on every single block that he goes up against. Now, he was a lot of the time in college too, and that wasn't a huge issue. So because there's not a huge precedent for a guy that's built like that at the NFL level, I'm not saying he can't do it, but I am interested to see how it translates and how a team chooses to use him. That being said, the health situation, I know he has been healthy for a while now. I think it is going to scare some teams off just because of how extensive it is. I would not mind him as a fit for the Titans if he were to fall, but at 38, it'd be too rich for my blood.
Easton Freeze, host of the Hot Read podcast, Broadway Sports Media. We've talked a lot about the draft. The draft matters, of course. The draft is, you know, you try to find the best players. You try to set yourself up. But Easton, as far as I'm concerned, it comes down to the quarterback position. What are your thoughts currently as we head into year two of Will Levis?
We were speaking on the Hot Read podcast just the other day with quarterback coach Sean McAvoy, who is the personal quarterback coach for Malik Willis. But because of that, he does a lot of work with Will Levis as well. And so he spent a lot of time with him in the offseason. We were talking through the progress that he's made and the things that he's working on, his mentality. Of course, it's a big deal for any quarterback going into their second year, especially a high-profile quarterback, to actually have that offseason and not have to do the draft circus. It's really the first time in like 19 months of those guys' lives that they have some free time to get in the lab, to work on the things they need to work on, and really just focus on training football. And so I think Will Levis did enough in his first year to warrant a year or two of a trial run. He obviously warranted going into the season as a starter. It was, I'd say, on the whole, above average football, but not a whole lot above average. There were a number of things that he flashed where you saw, okay, yeah, we can work with that. And there were a number of times that he did some things that you simply can't do on a football field. And there were also maybe more times than the actual mistakes he made, mistakes he almost made, and he got bailed out. There were a number. I mean, he had one of the highest turnover-worthy play rates of any quarterback in the league last year. Now, that's not surprising coming from a rookie and a guy that's a gunslinger and a guy that is in that position in particular where you have, like, one, you know, reliable target downfield. You don't have anybody blocking. Like, it's just a bad situation on the whole. Anybody can see that they watched. And so it's not shocking that as a rookie, not taking a lot of snaps in camp and, you know, coming in halfway through the season and trying to figure it out on the fly, that there was a lot of ups and downs. That being said, I do think that he, I don't think there's any doubt he has the requisite skill set to become a strong NFL quarterback. He's got to continue to nail down that footwork, cleaning up some mechanics. He's got an incredibly quick release. He's got an incredibly strong arm. The decision-making needs to get a little bit better. The accuracy could stand to improve. His pocket management and feel could also improve. Those are all things that he's working on in this off-season process. But the other thing that can go underrated is not only does he have the requisite skill set if he can polish those raw traits to be an NFL quarterback and a star, but he also has, between the ears, he's got exactly what you need. You could tell me that a year from now, 2 years from now, we find out that Will Levis physically, his play on the field, just it didn't end up cutting it, and I would believe you. But there is no doubt in my mind, and there's no doubt in the mind of anybody that I talk to that knows him and has worked with him personally, that he has what it takes between the ears from a personality standpoint, from a drive standpoint. The guy's a psychopath, and I mean that in the nicest possible way. He is driven. He's a natural leader. He's incredibly active, proactive in the way that he approaches the game. And he lives, eats, sleeps, breathes football. And that's what you want in your starting quarterback. So I think he's got a lot going for him. The Titans obviously have done a better job of putting a situation around him that's viable to, you know, develop and become a starting quarterback in the NFL, a bona fide starting quarterback. And he's going to have to take advantage of it. They just need to add some protection for him.
So if I'm asking you, over the next three drafts, including tomorrow night, do the Titans have to invest any more major capital in the quarterback position? You would say yes or no?
From a historical standpoint, I think the answer is yes, just because finding a starting quarterback in the NFL is really hard. But you can tell I'm not comfortable answering the question because
I think it's a coin flip.
Yeah, it feels 50-50 to me. It really does. And I don't think that's something that Titans fans should be disheartened by, because, you know, go through the league. How many teams are in a quarterback situation where they feel 50-50 they've got their franchise guy right now? It's a lot fewer than you think. I'll sure I'll be much more comfortable answering that question by Halloween, right? If we see six more games from this guy in a more modern quarterback-friendly offensive system with some more help around him, it feels like a question that is a really incomplete answer right now, because what we've seen from him is there's so many extenuating circumstances.
More important free agent signing, Lloyd Cushenberry or Calvin Ridley?
Lloyd Cushenberry was not a sexy addition, but listen, you know, as of right now, they don't have a starting tackle on either side of the ball. Not one that you're comfortable with. And you need somebody other than Peter Skoronski that you can actually rely upon up front. So Lloyd Cushenberry being the center, being the quarterback of that offensive line right now, maybe playing a more important role in terms of keeping Will Levis on the field and making the offense functional. In terms of a force multiplier, Calvin Ridley can't be discounted, though, right? Because having DeAndre Hopkins and Calvin Ridley on the field together presents a significant problem for a defense. It's like when you go from having one kid to two kids, parents tell you that it's a big jump going from one to two as opposed to going from zero to one, because suddenly you got to split your attention, you've got to divide and conquer, and that's what defenses are going to have to do with Calvin Ridley and DeAndre Hopkins on the field. I think the presence of both of those guys is also going to open up opportunities for wide receivers down the depth chart who are going to be getting some tertiary attention out there. Treylon Burks, Kyle Phillips, Nick Westbrook-Ikhine, they could really take advantage of some of those situations. So Ridley is a strong player, and he's coming off of a year where he had 1,000 yards and 8 touchdowns, despite everybody, including himself, considering it a down year for him. If those numbers are a down year for him, I'm excited to see what a not-so-down, not-so-rusty year is from him with the Titans this year. So ultimately, to answer your question, I'll say in terms of the offense functioning, it's probably Lloyd Cushenberry. But in terms of the offense scoring, it's Calvin Ridley.
Hey, one more question that I have, and it's a tie-in when you talk about Ridley and the receiving core. Everything I'm looking at, and you've talked a little bit about that second-round pick, I see a lot of projections. I see all sorts of receiver names. I see Ladd McConkey. I see Adonai Mitchell. I see Keon Coleman. But you're of the mind that it's, well, I, maybe provisional because of what goes on in the first round, but it's you're of the mind that it's more of a defensive player, right? That's what you're projecting?
I would guess it's more likely to be a defensive player. Here's the deal. If they don't go tackle in the first round, I don't see any world in which they cannot go tackle in the second. If they come out of those top two picks, they don't trade back, number 7 and number 38 are something other than at least one tackle, Titans fans should start to panic. I don't know what the plan is there. I don't see that happening at all. So, assuming the first round is going to be a tackle, I think that opens up the opportunity for them to take a receiver in the second, should they fall in love with one of these guys. It would not shock me if they loved, I think Ricky Pearsall is a really underrated player out of Florida who's going to go in the second round, has inside-outside versatility, just does everything really, really strongly, has a great catch radius and impressive at the catch point. So I could see him working in this Titans offense. A guy like Xavier Legette, I could see them really being fond of. He's similar to Treylon Burks in his skill set, but I think that his ceiling might be a little bit higher. But in terms of receivers that are going to be available at 38, it's kind of a weird list. Like Ladd McConkey, I'll be surprised if he falls to 38. I think he's going to go before then. Adonai Mitchell, the same boat. I think he'll likely be a first-rounder, even though I think there are some red flags with him. I don't see Xavier Worthy as a guy that they would be particularly interested in. Obviously, that speed is really sexy, and speed kills in the NFL. It can't hurt to have a guy that can fly like that. I know the Colts are very, very strongly into Xavier Worthy. It wouldn't shock me if they or somebody else ended up. The Dolphins, for example, Mike McDaniel loves some speed. Wouldn't shock me if somebody got really excited for him and overdrafted him in the first round. I'm really not a fan of Troy Franklin out of Oregon. He has potential to be a true outside X receiver, big body, but he had a lot of catch troubles in college. I don't love his game, and watching him do some of the testing at the combine, the way that he runs, his game speed is slow. The way that he runs is kind of flimsy. He doesn't do it for me. Keon Coleman is a guy that I like a lot, but analytically speaking, he might be the most controversial player in this draft just because analytically he kind of stinks. He's big and he's strong, but he's slow. His play speed is much stronger than his testing speed. So people like that are a fan of him advocate for just let the guy play ball. I don't care about the numbers, but you do have to care about the numbers at some point. So I'd be kind of surprised if they loved Keon Coleman at 38. But yeah, it's kind of a dead zone for receivers, to be honest with you. I like more of the receivers in the third round, which, again, they don't have a pick there, but if they were to trade and get a third-round pick, would not shock me if they loved a Malachi Corley out of Western Kentucky, who's a shorter, more stout, yards-after-catch monster, incredible once he has the ball in his hands. Javon Baker out of UCF, former Alabama wide receiver who has inside-outside versatility, is going to be a really fantastic player at the next level, I think, and a value for somebody in the third round. Malik Washington is like a poor man, Zay Flowers, who I know Rand Carthen was awfully fond of in the first round last year, even though the Titans didn't end up drafting him. He was the entirety of Virginia's offense last year. He'll be available in the third round. Even Jermaine Burton, a really controversial name, wide receiver out of Alabama, who has first-round talent on the field from a pure talent standpoint, may very well be wide receiver 4 or 5 in this class. But off the field, every team he's ever been around has told people in no uncertain terms, don't touch this guy with a 10-foot pole. So where he ends up going, I don't know, but I'd imagine somebody is going to say, we can't turn down the potential in this kid in round 3 or 4, so he's another guy that's there. But generally speaking, yeah, second-round receiver, it's a possibility for the Titans, and they may feel it's a need, and they may feel that they love one of the guys that's there. But generally speaking, I'm not a huge fan of the crop of guys that are available.
Easton Freeze, great stuff. You brought it. You made us smarter. Subscribe to the Hot Read podcast. Give him a follow on X at Easton Freeze. On the way out, I just want one word answer. You're in the GM room. Number 7 comes up. Joe Alt, or you could trade back to number 12 and grab a couple extra picks. You taking Alt or you trading? One word.
Trade. So easy. No thought.
Appreciate the time, brother.
Hey, thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Easton.
Sam, that same scenario. Trade back to 12, taking Joe Alt at 7.
I think I might trade back, too. I mean, grabbing a left tackle in these days in football is a hot commodity, and, that may be one move that kind of comes back to bite you in the ass. But I do, you know, I do kind of agree with him. I think that there are some holes with this team, and I think you've got the best offensive line coach in football, and, you know, they've talked about how deep of a class that this offensive tackle class is. If they feel confident in some of the deeper guys, I think I'd be fine trading back. I want that round three pick.
I've got some data about offensive lines in the NFL.
Yeah, they're all first-round picks.
I got some other data, though, that I want to talk about after the break. Stick with us. So a trade back vote for Sam. I've been alt for a lot of the time. Alt the receiver. The trade back, I think, always sounds better in theory. I guess if you have a GM that can hit picks, then it makes a lot of sense. Like that, maybe that was New England's problem, because New England's kind of soured the trade back for me. Because they just traded back for so long. It's all Belichick want to do is trade back, trade back, trade back. And then eventually you run out of blue chippers. You run out of, like, the top-end talent. So maybe they've soured it for me. I gave Titans GM Rand Carthon a little bit of credit for being, you know, a guy that could find diamonds in the rough. I thought he had a good draft last year. But then he told me yesterday it wasn't his first draft. Like, this is his first draft coming up. To which I do think Easton's explanation of, like, yeah, he didn't really get to go through the full entire process. He got hired and only had a couple months to really scramble. I think that's a logical one. But I was looking and I found this chart of draft capital used by teams on the offensive line in the draft over the last 5 years. Now, over the last 5 years makes it a little bit, I want to say wonky, but, like, it maybe could explain some things. But when you think of the best teams in the NFL, you think of guys that have good offensive line. You think of good drafters as well. But when I've looked at draft capital used by teams over the last 5 years, it makes me a little nervous, because already, Sam, the Titans are at number five, the fifth most draft capital used on offensive linemen. You know, you took Skorinski, you took Isaiah Wilson in the first round, so, I mean, that skews it. Wilson, of course, a bust, and that really kind of threw the whole franchise for a loop. But just like the rest of the teams at the top of the list, I don't think have fared much better. The team that's used the most draft capital on their offensive line are the New York Giants.
This is just 5 years, though, right?
Just 5 years.
Does it go back further than five?
Not the graphic I have. Not the graphic I have. Has someone done 10? Maybe. I don't have access to it. I didn't run the numbers myself. But, yeah, I mean, I do think if you went 10, maybe it tells a different story, because typically if you're going to spend that in the last 5 years, you've kind of stunk, so maybe you need it.
Like, where are the Lions at right here?
The Detroit Lions coming at 23rd. Penei Sewell would still be in the last 5 years, right?
Yeah. I think a lot of their other guys might be first-rounders, like, you know, in their career, but definitely are longer than five-year guys.
The number two team in terms of draft capital, the Jets, which is kind of funny because both those New York teams still have bad offensive lines.
Yeah.
The number three team, the Vikings, which I'll say the Vikings have kind of fixed their offensive line. That gives me some hope. Number four, the Falcons. I don't really have any strong takes on the Falcons offense. We just blame that with Arthur Smith and Desmond Ridder.
They've got some good pieces on that line, though.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think of their offensive line as a weakness or anything, but it hasn't led to winning yet for one reason or the other. And the Titans at number five. On the flip side, when I look at the teams that have invested the least amount, congrats to your Colts, Bob. They have invested the least amount in their offensive line over the last 5 years. But you could say, like, hey, Quentin Nelson – had been there for a while. Their center had been there for a while. He's gone now, though, right? So in terms of their long-term center. Did he hang it up, or did I make that up?
We're talking about Ryan Kelly?
Yeah, did he hang it up, or is he still around?
I think he might be gone.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But they had, you know, they used a lot of draft capital, you know, probably like Sam said, if you go and move that 5 years back. But Colts are the last. but like near them, the 49ers at 31st and the Chiefs at 30th. Hmm. Which I don't know if there's something to take away from this. The bad teams seem to spend a lot of capital on offensive linemen, but they're bad teams for a reason, probably because they have to fix their offensive line. The Chiefs and 49ers don't use draft capital on offensive linemen. They found their left tackle. They got such a blessing getting Trent Williams in a trade.
Ripped them off, too.
Ripped them off. Like, you know, like the shrewdness of John Lynch. He's had some swings and misses. The Trey Lance trade is one of the worst moves in NFL history, especially when you look at the guys drafted behind him. Not quarterbacks, but just the guys drafted behind him. And you know, like, he's overcome it with just two of the best moves maybe in NFL history. Getting Trent Williams for, was it basically a fourth-round pick?
Fifth and a third.
Yeah, I was going to say it was nothing.
One of the best left tackles ever.
Yeah.
He was coming off of the cancer, though, wasn't he?
Well, the cancer was like a, I'm pretty sure, correct me if I'm wrong, the cancer was that not just a knot in his head? Was it not like just like skin cancer in his head? Like, I don't think Trent Williams had like.
Yeah, no, he wasn't like.
But, like, it was like he – I don't even know if it was – was it cancer? Are you sure it was cancer? Because I know he got mad at the 49ers because they, like, misdiagnosed him and the trainer messed his head up and that led to them having to cut a chunk of it out. And, like, he lost trust in the Washington medical staff. It was like, I'm not playing for them ever again. I think is how that went down. And then, of course, them finding Brock Purdy, at least a serviceable to good quarterback with the last pick.
A long, long name of whatever he was diagnosed with that I'm not going to be able to – pronounced, but he said it was a rare soft tissue tumor, develops deep in the skin and was, quote, within weeks of metastasizing through to my brain, to my skull.
Yes, okay, so something in his head that they misdiagnosed, and I guess it could have ended up killing him and giving him brain cancer. I didn't realize it was that serious, but I know he was mad that Washington had dropped the ball there. Right. So, like, you the data you have is right. Basically, every left tackle that's good in the NFL is a first-round pick. Mm-hmm. Or I guess you get lucky and trade for one in Trent Williams. But, yeah, when I look at this, I don't know if I want the Titans to invest any more capital in the offensive line. I know they have to, though. But, like, it just doesn't look like it's something that good teams do. But maybe, like you said, we need years six through 10 on the data.
I'm more of the belief, not that it's, like, Joe Alt that isn't the guy, but more, like, I think that the gap between Joe Alt and tackle number two or three, given that you've got Bill Callahan as your offensive line coach, I think you can make that up with his coaching. And then you can, you know, recoup a couple picks on the back end and try and get a third round pick, maybe pick up another, you know, top 100 pick like we were talking about. But yeah.
What's the difference between really solid left tackle, a solid starter, and an all pro left tackle? Because if you draft Joe Alt at 7, he better be an all pro.
Yeah.
People say he has all-pro potential. I don't know about most draft years. Maybe it's something we can look up in preparation for tomorrow's mega draft show. But, like, how often can you get the best lineman in the draft at number 7? Feels like most years that guy's gone by number 7, right? Some years that's the number 1 overall pick. But usually I feel like by the top 5 you've had at least one offensive tackle taken. Usually. So if you can get an all-pro guy and get the best guy in the draft, it's hard for me to turn down.
I just had one of my buddies send me this, actually. It's kind of something similar to what your chart that you're bringing out, John. But it says that this is pulling from the PFF grades.
Uh-huh.
From 2019 to 2021, the offensive line starters, 51% of starters at left tackle were first-round picks.
Well, I think we're on the same page that we want left tackle to be the pick.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't really want a receiver unless it's Marvin Harrison Jr. Like, if he falls to 7, okay, like, maybe he's too good to pass up. But I want an offensive lineman in the first round for sure. I'm more so interested, Bob, in if you think the price between good starter and all-pro left tackle is more or less than, like, an extra third-round pick. And maybe a second-round pick next year, because it's kind of like what you might have to judge. Because I think, you know, Easton said, yeah, 7-12, move down for sure. Let's just grab the second-best offensive lineman. If the first guy's actually an all-pro, like they're saying,
yeah,
is that worth a second- and third-round pick? Because I don't know if it is or not. I'm curious what you think.
I would that's the part we don't know, is whether, you know, we don't have the crystal ball, but if they're an all pro, I mean, speaking as a Colts fan, for example, we mentioned Quentin Nelson earlier. I love the fact that we've had someone of that caliber there, and I've never thought for a second about what we might have been able to get with that high draft pick in terms of additional draft capital. I think it's such an important and overlooked role that if you have that crystal ball and you think the guy can be an all-pro, I would jump at that. I really would.
I think that's most years, right, though? Like, most years the first offensive lineman has those type that type of potential, right? That type of ceiling and that type – really, I mean, like the lowest – or the highest floor, the lowest risk, the highest floor of any prospect. Like, usually you can say, hey, the first offensive lineman is going to be a day one starter. Can't always say that with quarterback. Can't always say that with receiver. Maybe cornerback. You feel like you could plug and play those guys. I don't know. But, like, the first offensive lineman is always supposed to be a really good player. That's kind of my draft philosophy. That's one of my thoughts on the draft. It's the safest. Is it the lowest bust rate? I would say so. Like, what's busted out more? The top receiver taken, the top offensive lineman taken, the top quarterback taken? Like, if you just go position wise, because it feels like offensive line's the safest.
Yeah, I'd say, particularly based on the past, you know, X amount of years, not that many, it'd be quarterback, right, that has the biggest bust rate.
I would think so. But yeah, I mean, like, typically, I would say a lot of that, Bob, is probably because you're taking a quarterback and putting behind a bad offensive line, which is all kind of tied together. Like, yeah, if you're the first quarterback taken, your team usually sucks. That's part of the problem. And if you suck, your offensive line's probably bad, or you don't have any skill position players to get. So, like, it's hard to be the first quarterback. It's a lot harder. But, yeah, like, the other positions I'm more interested in. Because I just think if you're the first lineman taken, that gap should be pretty big between 1 and 2 and 3 and all that. So, like, I think I lean towards alt for that reason. But I'm not Rand Carthen. I'm not an NFL GM. I openly talk about how I can't project these guys. I don't really know. Like, you can tell a couple guys stink, but there's been plenty of guys I thought were going to be really good that ended up not being really good. I won't pretend like I'm breaking down offensive lineman film. I'm just going off what everybody says. I'm ready for the draft tomorrow.
Me too.
A little bit of a side note, but former NFL player, Reggie Bush is going to get his Heisman back.
Yeah, I meant to drop that in the break. I forgot about that.
I was going to have a different segue just then. I was going to say draft day makes me think of Johnny Manziel because of the Drake song. And Johnny Manziel makes me think of Reggie Bush because he's been beating the drum the last couple of years about how much, you know, Reggie deserves to be back reinstated and how he's going to – I think Johnny even went as far as being like, I'm going to quit coming around the Heisman stuff until Reggie's back.
Yeah, he said he was going to stop.
Yeah.
He was like, give up his trophy or something
like
that.
Yeah, he's like, I don't want to be a part of it if you're not going to give it back to Reggie.
Uh-huh.
Didn't Wendy's kind of do a commercial that a little tongue-in-cheek about the Heisman, too?
They did.
Maybe OJ sent a note to the Heisman committee before he went out.
Maybe that was a final straw. People was like, so you guys are going to put that out celebrating OJ, right?
Yeah.
You never came back after his Heisman after being accused of double murder at the worst. And at the very best, went to prison for, like, armed robbery. Yeah, it was his own stuff, but it was armed robbery. Like, and you're going to put out that about OJ, but – Reggie Bush doing what every athlete has pretty much done. You know, all the big-time athletes have been getting money, it feels like, for a long time. And now they're just openly, you know, going to the highest bidder. And you're still going to be mean to Reggie, huh?
That's what he told his family. Not like I did it at the end. It was like,
give Reggie his trophy.
Reggie needs the Heisman.
Yeah. A no-brainer.
Yeah.
It was just funny they talk about their moral code and all that, but it's like, again, OJ, you still got OJ. You still celebrate him. I don't think they were like letting him come to the ceremony anymore. Was he just not invited? Did he just not want to show up? Because, you know, they always, you know, have the past winners on stage. Like, would they have allowed him to come stand on stage if he was like, hey, I'm showing up?
Maybe it was a mutual agreement.
I feel like OJ would have liked the attention. I feel like he would have liked to have been on stage. I don't know. He should have forced their hand. Let me on.
Made a hello Twitter world with the next Heisman winner.
Could put him in the Heisman house. Could add some really good commercials there. That could have been a good. That could have been good skits.
That would be a good like SNL skit.
Yeah, I was gonna say maybe SNL. You know, back when it was funny. That's what everyone always says whenever they talk about SNL. You gotta throw in back when it was funny. But yeah, like you could have had a Heisman House with OJ,
mm-hmm.
and just make it like a spoof of Scream.
Yeah,
where you're running through the house and someone's chasing you. You could have had something.
That was good.
Maybe that's it. It's a Scream spoof, but then the mask reveal is OJ, and you realize you're in the Heisman House.
He's stabbing you through the door.
It could have been good.
Bo Jackson would have killed him.
Could have been good. They should do an actual Heisman House. Like, some of those guys ain't got nothing going on, right?
Just make them live there.
Yeah, let's do a couple weeks of content. Yeah, let's get some actual Heisman House stuff. Well, Tebow, I mean, he gets, although Tebow's, you know, he's doing some good. I see him with the sex trafficking stuff down in Florida and around the country.
I haven't seen that.
Yeah, he's like, you know, trying to fight for victims and get all that. So, like, he's kind of stepped out of the limelight, but he's still doing good work. What's Barry Sanders up to? I mean, Lions games, I guess. I mean, he's already doing the commercials. Let's just do a little 2 week real world type of thing. Heisman House edition. Manziel's not got anything going on.
Sanders looks great, too. It's like, you know, him leaving early. I think about that. It's like, I think about Earl Campbell went from way back when, can barely walk. Barry left early, looks great. Probably at peace with his decision.
Yeah, I would say he's like, I was, and honestly, like, 30's not that young to retire whenever you look at, like, the way the running backs age. Like, at the time, I was like, I can't believe you retired after only, like, what was it, 8 seasons? Like, it's kind of smart. Like, running backs kind of break down, and maybe he was like, hey, I'm not going to ruin my legacy. Kind of smart.
How much you're running back then, too. Like, it's not the passing league that it is today.
Last call on the other side. 10 seasons. 10 seasons, not even 8. 10. That's a good running back career. That's too long. He overstayed his welcome. Last call on the other side.
Ever been the coach?
Certainly effective. 38 assists on 50 buckets. And Pascal Siakam, now I understand the trade. You know, I mean, I still think Tyrese is a little banged up, but Siakam's carried him the first 2 games. I mean, it didn't matter in game one, but last night he was a machine.
Yeah, 37 points and 11 rebounds. I'm going to wait and hold off to see what Siakam does in case Giannis comes back.
Yeah.
It's easy to do that against Bobby Portis. It's another thing to do that against Giannis, of course. But, you know, Indiana can take advantage of him not being out there. And if you're Milwaukee, I think at a certain point you're going to have to make a tough decision, because do you bring back a Giannis with a calf injury on a team that's probably not championship good regardless, but you also have an aging point guard in Dame Lillard that doesn't have many more years and cracks at it? I would just be terrified of calf injuries after watching Kevin Durant tear his Achilles. I think with Giannis I would be really slow, especially now that it's 1-1 and you know you're going to be in a dogfight with that Pacers team anyways. Is Giannis – is it worth risking him getting hurt for a full season?
Yeah, and there's clearly there was a little bit of bad blood during the regular season in this series when they played each other. It sounds like it's already happening in the playoffs. Bobby Portis is calling them a bunch of front runners, calling the Pacers that, saying, yeah, it's all good when you're winning, you're laughing it up and, you know, fronting. And now Halliburton saying that there was racial slur thrown at his brother in game one. Yeah.
It's always so tough.
Yeah.
Because, like, it paints the whole franchise and fan base away. It could be one, like, rogue fan says one thing, but then it's a headline like, hey, you got a Bucks fan. You're like, oh, man, come on.
Yeah.
I got to imagine throughout the time of Neyland Stadium, there's been at least one person inside Neyland Stadium watching a Tennessee football game that has said something questionable, and then it's just like, Vols fan, and it just completely, like, paints you as a – as an entire lie. That's always really tough.
I couldn't help but think he's, you know, they're just grabbing stuff too, right, to get everybody fired up on the team and everything else. So, but they've had some real petty, in my opinion, petty disputes going on during the regular season as well. I mean, the in-season tournament with, you know, Halle doing the Dame time mock and then the whole deal where Giannis – it was his 60-point game in the regular season against the Pacers, and they had game balls. There were two of them, and Giannis wanted apparently wanted both of them. Pacers took one because they wanted to give it to Oscar Tshiebwe because he got his first NBA bucket in that game, and they had a big dispute at the end of the game. And
they have two game balls? They switch them out of half? Or
I don't know. It was in Milwaukee, too. I don't know. It was weird. But
I just remember Giannis trying to get inside the Pacers locker room to get it. It was a whole thing. So, yeah, those teams don't like each other. That's the beauty of any playoff series in any sport is that
yeah.
if you play somebody four, five, six times in a row, you're going to start hating them. You're going to start really becoming annoyed as a fan base at their players, and as a player, you're going to become really annoyed with the guys you're going up against. So hopefully that's a long series. I would just be pretty cautious if I was a Bucks fan with Giannis and trying to bring him back. But he's the type of guy that's going to want to play if he can.
Yeah.
You also had the Mavericks spoil Kawhi's return and beat the Clippers 96-93. Another one of those low-scoring games in the NBA playoffs. Luka and Kyrie were really good and helped carry that team, and Mavericks get their home court advantage. So at least we got a couple of 1-1 series now.
Yeah, we've said it before with Kyrie. He's playing at a high level. He had a couple plays last night, opposite hand floater, like at a clutch. I mean, when Kyrie's on, I do love watching him play. I mean, obviously Luka's a stud as well, but they scored 55 of the Mavs 96. So, yeah, that evens things up. Kawhi was definitely rusty, but he's been out, 3 weeks? It's been a while.
And the Suns lose to Minnesota. That was one that was a head-scratcher to me coming into that series. I mean, I knew they were 3-0 against them in the regular season, but I thought Minnesota was so much better than Phoenix the entire year, and everyone was picking Phoenix. Phoenix was favored, and Phoenix still might come back and win the series, but I think Minnesota's a better team.
Yeah.
And it's going to take Booker and Durant going absolutely nuclear to win that series. They weren't nuclear last night. They only combined for 38 between them, and Bradley Beal, 6 of 17, only 14 points. As they lose to Minnesota, and that was with Minnesota getting pretty much nothing from Anthony Edwards. He ends up with 15, but on 3 of 12 shooting, and had 5 points for the first half. Like, didn't really do much at all. And Karl Anthony Towns only had 12 points on 3 of 7, but it didn't matter as they lose 105-93. Another one of those low scoring games.
Yeah, Jaden McDaniels gets 25. That, who saw that coming? Nobody, I don't think. But hey, tonight, Mr. Betting Man, Boston minus 14.5 against Miami. What would you take there?
If I'm taking it one way or the other, I mean, probably taking Boston. Like, I'm staying away from it, but it's crazy. 203.5 over under and a 15-point spread. Usually that doesn't line up. Like, if the scoring is going to be at such a premium, usually a team can get to 95 points and cover. But they're like, or I guess even like 88 points is, or 89 points is going to be their team total. But Celtics are a machine, man, and Miami is old, and Miami's not very good. So if I was betting, I would take Boston minus 14.5, but I would stay away otherwise. Yeah. Pelicans Thunder, I mean, that first game was pretty interesting. Interested to see if the Pelicans can kind of run it back and stay in that game and maybe steal it in game two, or if Oklahoma City gets past the jitters and kind of makes a statement of why they're the one seed.
Yeah, Zion saying it's realistic he could come back, but I don't know if I'm buying that. I don't think it's anytime soon. We'll have to see.
Sam, I got an update for you. Jake Miller tells me he's a good shooter. Okay. And that they're willing to play us 3-on-3, maybe 4-on-3.
It doesn't surprise me. Thinks he's a good shooter.
The G.I. Jake Show coming up next. Stay locked in on Fan Run Radio.